Intersectionality just simply means that if you are advocating for a group of people, say women, that you need to advocate for all women, and understanding that various parts of people's identities intersect in ways that change the reality of their lived experiences. And obviously, those intersections can be found in many different aspects of identity.
This is the She Innovates podcast, and I'm your host, Michelle King. On our show, we share the challenges and triumphs of women in areas like innovation, technology, and entrepreneurship. So one of the things people always ask me is how they can get involved in the gender equality movement. So today we've got the absolute pleasure of speaking with Emma Gray, the executive women's editor at HuffPost. Emma's actually written a book on this topic. It's titled A Girl's Guide to Joining the Resistance. It's a feminist handbook on how we can fight for good. So on this episode, you're going to be hearing from Emma about practical ways that you can get involved and stay involved in the gender equality movement today. As a journalist, Emma's engaged in conversations with fellow activists, thought leaders, and even the organizers of the Women's March. And one of the things that she's found from all of these conversations is that young women play an absolutely critical role in the resistance. So Emma, welcome to She Innovates.
Thank you.
It's just so fantastic to have you here today.
Of course. I appreciate it.
So look, before we get started and get into your book and all the work that you're doing, I just wondered, you know, if you could share a little bit about your background, just for our listeners who may be not familiar with your work.
So I grew up outside Washington, D.C. in a very politically active family. So I feel like activism and political engagement was sort of built into my childhood, just growing up around people who were involved in protests and marches and being so close to that political center of our country, just distance-wise. I also went to a summer camp that really focused on issues of social justice. And that was just sort of baked into my childhood and family life. And then I went to school abroad. I moved to New York and became a journalist, and I focused largely on the intersection of gender, culture, and politics.
Yeah, so just on politics, I know you covered the 2016 elections. So could you tell us a little bit about that experience?
I was at the Javits Center where the Clinton campaign was on election night, and my team and I thought we would be writing a story about our nation's first woman president being elected, as did a lot of people. And obviously, we ended up writing a very different story and ended up spending, you know, until the early hours of the next morning on the street, interviewing a lot of very scared, grief-stricken, angry people who were streaming out of the Clinton campaign's public-facing block party. And then a few months later, I got the chance to go down to DC to cover the first women's march and really saw what it looks like when that grief and fear and anger is channeled into civic action. And that was just a really powerful contrast for me. And it made me want to situate this moment within a historical context and really dig into the women that were leading the resistance.
Well, I mean, that must have been an amazing experience. And it kind of, you know, it kind of leads me to my next question, which is really about your book. You know, so what are you hoping to achieve? Who's your book for? Could you tell us a little bit about that?
I wanted to speak directly to young women. Young women are a demographic that are socialized to believe that they should make their voices smaller. They should make themselves smaller, that their viewpoints are to be dismissed. And that is why I directed the advice in the book specifically to young women, sort of a call to arms to this generation who, you know, by the way, does not really need my call to arms because they are already doing this. But I also feel like what's in there is really applicable to men. It's applicable to women of all ages. And young women have spent their whole lives, all women really, finding themselves and pieces of themselves in things that are written by and for men. So while I encourage men to read the book, and I hope that they will be able to connect to it, I also think it's sort of like, you know, welcome dudes, if we've spent our lives finding things to connect to in literature and pop culture that is not written by and for us, like, you can do the same. Use a little imagination.
So Emma, you know, one of the challenges, I guess, is we've had a lot of movements, right? We've had Me Too, we've had Time's Up. So how does your book fit in with that? Or, you know, how does your book help with that?
It can be incredibly overwhelming to want to be informed, want to be involved, and yet not quite know where to start because there are so many different parts of this quote unquote resistance that one can tap into. I think it's hard to know what your entry point should be. And sometimes when you get overwhelmed, it's helpful to have a resource to sort of ground you, to just go back to remind you that, yes, you can do this. Yes, this is important. Here's why. And also, these tasks can be manageable. And it's so interesting because I wrote the book almost completely before Me Too even began in earnest. Obviously, Tarana Burke coined that phrase, you know, a decade ago, but the current Me Too moment started in late October. And that's when I was putting the very finishing touches, the last edits on the manuscript. And what I find to be so heartening about the end product of this book is that it's not specific to just one aspect of this movement. It is basic advice. It is a primer for anyone who wants to get involved. And I hope that that will have a really long shelf life. I hope that the advice to own your narrative and tell your story and use that to fuel your political organizing, you know, that can be applied to movements past and it can be applied to movements future. And the reason that we need this now, the reason that women need this now, is because there's such an onslaught of information and there are so many women who have stepped up and said, I want to get involved. And that's the need that I was kind of trying to address.
You know, that's great that women want to get involved. But I just wonder from your perspective, you know, why is it particularly important that we have young women's voices represented in the resistance? You know, why do we need young women to speak up?
Women make up more than half of the population. That's a good place to start. And so our government and our policies should reflect that, should reflect those demographics. It should reflect a diversity of thought, a diversity of experience, a diversity of gender identity, racial identity, sexuality. Our representatives should reflect the world around us. And a healthy political system is one where everyone's voices are engaged. Unfortunately, we know that when it comes to gender, you know, in the United States, we are not at parity, not even close. In our government, in the business sector, in most positions of power. And often the research says that women need to kind of be asked specifically. We are socialized to need to be we are completely qualified before we take on a task. And whereas men are sort of fueled by and judged by their potential. And so I think speaking to women and young women directly and saying, this is for you, can be really helpful for the same reason that, you know, we've found that women need to be asked to run for office in a way that men don't. You know, there's a lot of underqualified men raising their hands and saying, of course I should, you know, be in elected office. Women often need a little bit more fuel.
So Emma, you know, one of the central themes that I've noticed in your book is intersectionality. It seems to play sort of a key role in the resistance. So could you maybe share for our listeners, you know, what that is and why you felt it was so important to include that as part of your message?
I was extremely aware going into writing this book that I was coming at this, yes, as a journalist, but also as a white, straight, cisgender woman who has experienced a significant amount of privilege in her life. And I wanted to make sure that I was using my platform to amplify women who came at this work from a lot of different perspectives. So that was probably the most important thing I had in mind when I started to write. And intersectionality just simply means that if you are advocating for a group of people, say women, that you need to advocate for all women, and understanding that various parts of people's identities intersect in ways that change the reality of their lived experiences. So Black women are not going to experience womanhood in the same way that white women are. And obviously, those intersections can be found in many different aspects of identity. But I think race is the one that is most frequently spoken about in terms of intersectionality. partially because Kimberly Crenshaw coined the term specifically when looking at the ways that racial and gender discrimination intersected for Black women in the workplace. So that's just something that's incredibly, incredibly key for anyone who wants to go into organizing or activism in any capacity to have in mind. We need to fight against our own tendencies to universalize our experiences, especially if we are a member of a privileged group. You know, women of color, they don't really necessarily need to talk about intersectionality or be defined by intersectionality because their lives are already defined by intersectionality. White women often need to take that extra step and say, I'm going to be intentional about the way that I am approaching these issues. I'm going to know when to step back from the conversation and be there to bolster my sisters of color. And I'm also going to keep these intersections in mind when I'm looking for solutions to big problems like sexual harassment in the workplace. I'm not going to only think about white collar office workers. I'm also going to think about what sexual harassment in the workplace looks like for domestic workers. I'm going to look at what sexual harassment looks like when you are also experiencing some amount of racial discrimination mixed in with that. And that's where the really creative, long lasting solutions are going to come from, rather than just a band-aid that is going to benefit one part of that group, and often, you know, the most privileged among that group.
You know, and I think that's great. And I think it's so important to capture those different perspectives. You know, one of the things that you touched on in the book is the power of storytelling. And with everything that's been happening, could you maybe share with our audience, you know, why you think storytelling is so critical?
It's so interesting because when I had the original outline for the book, that chapter wasn't even in it. And then once I started interviewing women, almost all of them brought up that point. And I thought, this is important. Of course, this is important. And I'm so glad that I ended up including it, not just because storytelling as a journalist has been so integral to my own way of creating empathy, my own way of, you know, moving about the world, but also because it is so essential to social movements. And just look at something like Me Too, which again, was not even happening when I wrote the book. And yet it is a perfect example of a movement literally built on storytelling. And when one person steps up and says, Me Too, and tells their story, they are opening up space for a lot of other people to say, Me Too, and tell those stories. And we see how those stories are literally creating change within entire industries, or at least setting off the hopefully beginnings of lasting change in those industries.
So Emma, I mean, one of the things I really loved about the book is it's actually really practical, right? I mean, it's something that people can pick up. It's kind of got a list of things that they can do in terms of how they can get involved. So what would be your kind of top 2 to 3 items that you would recommend people start doing today?
Of course, the first important step to any kind of activism is getting off of your couch. Although I understand the instinct to start there. We have a tendency, we live so much of our lives online, and online activism can be incredibly, incredibly powerful. But at a certain point, you have to take all of these things offline. And I think that sort of goes into what I was speaking about having those interpersonal conversations. I think that the best way to create culture change starts with intimate one-on-one conversations. Just like I was talking about before, for white women, for example, part of my responsibility as a white woman is engaging other white women on a lot of these issues. The same way that I would hope that when it comes to something like Me Too, that the men in my life would not just have conversations with me about it, but also would then go in turn and speak to other men. We also know that one-on-one conversations that include personal storytelling actually do kind of move the needle for individuals, and that is a lot more effective when the message is coming from someone that other person has a personal connection to, that other person feels is a part of their sort of in-group, which is why we can be really effective in our own families and our own communities. Also, by showing up, what I mean is physically be there for causes and for communities perhaps that you are not a part of. You know, if you are a white woman, go to a Black Lives Matter march. If you are not an immigrant, go show up at an airport and say, I stand with immigrant communities, you know, during a Muslim ban protest. There is an incredible power in numbers. And it is most often the most vulnerable among us who are the ones putting their bodies out there and risking their physical safety for the safety of other members of their community. And it can be very powerful when people who are not part of those communities also show up and just be a physical presence at these actions.
So Emma, you know, there's like a common thread in everything that you've been talking about. For me, you know, the takeaway is really around this idea of getting comfortable in the uncomfortable, right? You know, I often share this example of my husband who came along to the Women's March, but I mean, for the record, he is a straight white male who's never been to any march in his life. So he was pretty uncomfortable that day, but you know, he showed up. He told me that he wanted to go because he felt that it was the right thing to do. So I just wondered, you know, I mean, do you have any advice on this? You know, how people can show up even if they're feeling uncomfortable?
Getting uncomfortable is a key part of this process. And just sitting with that and asking yourself, why is this uncomfortable? And also taking some of the pressure off of yourself. Some of the best advice that I got was from Sarah Sophie Flicker, who is a white organizer who helped organize the National Women's March. And she is a white woman who organizes alongside women of color all the time. And something that she said to me was that, you know, white women activists often get so nervous that you're going to show up, you're going to say the wrong thing, you're going to put your foot in your mouth. And I'm sure that is also how a lot of men feel in this moment. And those feelings are completely understandable. But what she said was, you know, the beautiful thing is that you don't actually have to lead the conversation. You can show up and you can just listen, and it takes the pressure off. So I think that's a great place to start, to force yourself perhaps into a situation that is out of your comfort zone, and then just listen and learn and take it in. And once you've done that learning, that knowledge will probably make you feel a little bit more comfortable, a little bit more confident in why you are there, in what you are standing for. And then that's when you can start leading those conversations, not in that group, but in the group that you are, you know, the predominant member of. You know, how powerful would it be if your husband then went back and talked to a few of his friends about that experience that didn't show up, that did feel too uncomfortable to even go? And I think that is a really, really important part of all of this.
So look, I hope you all got some amazing insights from a conversation with Emma. One of the great things about Emma and her work and her book is just the practical component to all of this. Sometimes it can feel a little bit overwhelming to get involved in movements or marches. People don't always know where to start. And her book just provides a really practical approach for how to get started. For me, the major takeaway from a conversation with Emma is just this idea of getting comfortable in the uncomfortable. This idea of, you know, showing up, speaking up, standing up, and holding yourself accountable for the things that you believe in. I highly recommend her book if you are interested in the space and how you can get more involved. And, you know, thank you all for taking this on today and even listening to this podcast, right? Because that's a good first step. Thank you so much for joining me today to have this incredible conversation. Next week, I'm going to be joined by another incredible guest, Bruce Cleaver. He's the CEO of the diamond producing company De Beers. Bruce is going to be sharing how he shows up every day for the women in his workplace and some of the practical things that he does to make sure that women really have an equal seat at the table. So please stay tuned for next week's episode.
She Innovates is produced by Human Group Media, a company that inspires people to do good through the power of audio storytelling. This podcast is made possible by SAP NextGen, an innovation platform that enables everyone, from individuals, companies, partners, and universities, to connect and innovate with purpose. In doing so, SAP NextGen supports the achievement of the Sustainable Development Goals.